Welcome to the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, where you get multifamily investing made real. Learn from top players in the real estate investment world as they share their secrets with you and discover proven strategies on apartment investing that actually work. To learn more about Wheelbarrow Profits, visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. Now to your hosts, Jake and Gino.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Stenziano, host of the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father of six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbaro. Gino, how's it going?
Stenziano. I'm doing great. How you doing, bro?
Always making it happen, big man. Today's guest is Jonathan Twombly. Jonathan is the president of Two Bridges Asset Management. Before founding Two Bridges, he was a partner in the real estate investment firm TRB Investment Group. He began his career as a lawyer and spent over a decade practicing in American top 100 firms. Jonathan holds a bachelor's degree from Harvard College and a law degree from Columbia University School of Law. So without further ado, Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So I want to find out about the jump. You were in law, then you went to real estate. Tell us about that and why you made the move.
Yeah, well, So I was in law for a long time, but I wasn't happy for most of that time doing it. Probably after the third year or so, it just became a real grind. You know, you can imagine working in a Wall Street firm. You know, it was like 12, 14 hours a day, six, sometimes 7 days a week. And even though, you know, the pay was great, the lifestyle sucked, and there was really little chance of advancement. It's so difficult to make partner at those firms at this point. I just didn't really see any future there, but I couldn't figure out what else to do. But I started thinking about, you know, after a couple of false starts to get out of that, I started thinking seriously about what I wanted to do. And one of my good friends is a really big fund manager, actually. And he said to me, look, you know, I've known you for a long time. We talk about investing all the time. You have the right temperament and the right outlook to be a value investor, which is what he does. And so that sort of planted a seed in my mind. I started thinking about finance and getting into finance. And when I started looking into it, I was already at this point, like in my late 30s, you know, and I started looking into it and I talked to people and do informational interviews, and they'd say to me, look, you have a great resume and you're a smart guy, but I'm just going to be honest with you. At your age, with your background, as a career changer, like, you're just not going to break into this field because you're not going to have, you know, no 25-year-old manager is going to want to tell you that you got to stay late and work when you're like 10 years older than him and you've got a family and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I kind of gave up on that idea. And then the financial crisis happened, you know, the bottom of the world fell out and I was just lucky to have a job. So I kept on plugging away at law, even though I wasn't happy with it. I started thinking about what else I could do. And I'd always been interested in real estate. And I got to a point after the financial crisis where I really had a lot of time on my hands because we didn't have much work to do at the firm. So I spent a lot of time looking at real estate. Like, I'd be online, I'd be on Trulia, like, you know, half the day looking at properties up in upstate New York, like in Albany or, you know, even Newburgh. Like, I know you guys know those markets. Yeah, well, I can tell you, maybe later we'll tell a story about Newburgh, but
I'll tell you a story about Newburgh.
Murder per capita.
Listen, when I was with the pharma company, we would drive through there in these like Ford Explorers and we had suits on, you know, because that's where we go in the doctors, and you'd see guys like come out in the street and they'd think you were like the feds, and you'd be driving down the street and they'd scramble. They'd just start running. It's so bad, man. So bad. Sorry, carry on, Jonathan. Sorry.
Yeah, So I was there, like, you know, looking at property online and trying to, you know, think about maybe going into real estate. And so I started thinking about that more and more, and started thinking about how I might go into real estate instead of finance. And again, started, you know, talking to people in the field, and was running up against very similar kinds of you know, responses that, you know, at your age and with your background and whatever, it's going to be very difficult breaking in. Plus, in New York, you know, real estate is all controlled by just a few families and they're really tight and they don't let outsiders in. And there was, you know, all this kind of 24 reasons why it'll never happen. Meanwhile, it was becoming pretty clear that my law career was wrapping up because just the work wasn't there. I saw the writing on the wall. And at one point I was doing some networking with an experienced real estate guy in New York. And he said to me, you know, let me break it down for you. The only way you're going to break in the city is if somebody just takes a liking to you and says, hey, how'd you like to be my partner? And a few weeks later, that actually happened. Someone I was networking with said, look, I'm starting a real estate investment firm of my own. How would you like to be my partner? And so I said, well, I'll think about it. In the meantime, I got termination notice from my firm. So I had like a few months of severance to kind of figure out what I was going to do.
That was a good nudge.
Yeah, totally. And my wife is from Japan, and we decided that we would go to, since I now had plenty of time on my hands, we would go back to Japan and visit her family. And while I was there, I met up with an old friend whose family is in real estate, and I said, hey, look, I've got this offer. I don't really know whether I should take this or not. I don't really know what to do. And he basically just sort of steamrolled me and said, you know, ignored the whole part about me saying, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do. He said, all right, when are you going back to New York? Is it next week? Okay, I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to be there. I'm going to come meet this partner of yours. If I like her, I'm going to give you $1 million to invest. And I said, okay. I still haven't even made up my mind about this yet. But there he was, like 2 weeks later in New York. We had a meeting. He was like, okay, I like this. Let's go. So I was like, well, I guess I better accept this offer because I've got this guy who wants to invest. And that was how the first firm that TRB that you mentioned in the intro, that's how that firm was formed. So I got laid off from my job, which is kind of what I wanted, and slid into this real estate startup. And that's how it got going.
There's two things I take away from that. Number one is the six human needs. You hit the fifth and sixth. You wanted growth and you wanted contribution. You were stuck in a job that you hated. I'm sure Jake can relate to that, and I can surely relate to that. I'm doing a business for 20 years and just getting bored. And same thing with 08. Once the numbers start drying up, it's like, what the heck? And the second thing is, whatever you put out in the universe, it seems to come back to you, right? You put out that vibe that someone tells you got to get a partner. And that's what happened with Jake and I. I was figuring out, how can I find somebody? How can I partner with somebody to get into this venture? And that's what happened to me. It just got just attraction between the two of us. We hit it off because we had very similar mindsets, skill sets, visions, goals. We want to buy and hold for cash flow and create wealth. And that's what happened. And your story is very similar to ours. That's really cool.
You know, what's really funny too, is that somewhere around 2007, I think it was, or 2008, I like to set goals at the beginning of the year. I carry around a little notebook and I kind of write like my top 10 goals in there or something. And so I had this little, it was like one of those little Moleskine notebooks, right? And the one that I had from that year sort of went someplace. And like, you know, a couple of years later, I found it and I opened it up and looked in the front cover, and it said like top kind of dream was start your own real estate investment company. And at the time when I wrote that, I was like, there's no way this is ever going to happen. Like, I was, you know, deep in my law career, utterly miserable, you know, really depressed. And when you're depressed, you know, you don't see options that you have right in front of your face, right? Tend to ignore them. So I wrote that as kind of like almost like a cry for help. Like, this is what I wish something magical would happen in my life and this would happen and rescue me. And, you know, like, mm-hmm. 4 years later, I found this thing. I'm like, oh my God, this is the weirdest thing ever.
So that's really powerful what you said. I like to talk about life coaching a lot. And what happens is, when you're in that misery, you have that level of energy that's just completely low. Everyone has to raise their level of energy before they can solve a problem. You can't solve a problem from being a victim or from having anger, right? That's where everyone wants to solve problems. You look at the way society is, the way government is, we're all at that victim and the anger stage. So when you can raise your level of energy, you clear your mind and you can see problems turn into opportunities. I mean, your problem of getting laid off was probably the best opportunity. You got on a plane, you got solutions. People would see that as, oh my God, I don't have a job. But if you can see that clearly as an opportunity, and entrepreneurs can see those as opportunities, it just opens the door for you, you know?
Yeah, and I'll tell you one other thing. I mean, you know, when I was a lawyer, well, one of the earlier times, and I tried to get out of law, and I just quit. You know, people always tell you, don't quit your job until you have another job lined up. You know, that's sort of standard career advice. It's too risky. You don't want a hole in your resume, all this kind of stuff. But if you're really, really, really unhappy and to the point where you can't think clearly, you've got to get out of the situation that makes you unhappy. And I remember very distinctly, you know, before I quit my job, I mean, I ultimately wound up going back into law for various reasons. But before I quit, I was, you know, I was so miserable. I couldn't think of anything to do. Anytime somebody made a suggestion to me, like, why don't you do this? I was like totally negative and said, I can't do that, or I don't want to do that, or whatever. The day I quit, it's unbelievable. I took some time off. I was at home. I'd be watching TV, and like, you know, the Apex Tech commercial would come on and be like, I could do that. Like, I mean, all of a sudden, like, I could do everything. Once I wasn't miserable anymore, like, everything was a possibility. Everything was an opportunity. So, you know, sometimes you got to get away from the stuff that's making you miserable before you're able to really focus and make clear decisions. So
it was tough for me because I was sort of in the same boat as you. I'm in the business with my parents and my brother. I can't get out of it. So what juiced me up was sitting down at lunchtime, writing articles, talking to Jake about deals. So I had the best of both worlds where I was still with my family, making money. I didn't like that. But at the same time, I found avenues. So I was working 65, 70 hours a week. And my mom would always tell me, stop at working. What are you working so hard for? And that's, you know, and she's an Italian off the boat who works 7 days a week, right? So I'm like, right. Mom, this is not work right now. There's a difference between work and being juiced. They don't understand it. The old timers think of work as going to work, getting a paycheck, making money. But to us, the new guys, work is actually, you know, it's invigorating, it's inspiring, talking to people, making it happen, like Jake says, and raising your level of energy and being engaged. And I think that's what work should be. And a lot of us don't look at work as that way. And that's why it's the one thing. It's life's definite purpose. We don't know what that is. We all have to figure out what that one thing is for everybody. And once you figure it out, the sky's the limit. And it's not just about making money. It's about being engaged and helping others. And that's what I found. So, I mean, like you said, I couldn't quit my job either because I was with my brother and I have a large family. So I had to figure out an in-between. So that's how I figured it out. I said, during my downtime at home, read the books, education, get on the phone with Jake 2 or 3 times. Because it's amazing. Get on the phone with this guy. You get your level of energy is raised. You're talking about great stuff. And I was looking forward to those conversations daily. And like when I, you know, and I didn't get on the phone with him for a half a day, it'd be like, Jake, I got to Jake syndrome. I'm missing him, missing the love, you know?
And, well, we were growing though. So it was always like, there was always like something on the horizon and we still are, but it was always like, what's the next move? And what are we going to do next? And how are we going to grow the business? So it's fun stuff though.
Yeah. I love your story. I want to know one question. Why real estate though? What attracted you to real estate?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I guess I understood for a long time that it is potentially very lucrative. You know, I mean, that was primarily what it is. And I think I perceived, and I have to say that this was wrong before I got into it, that it was easy, right? I mean, and I think that that's a big misconception.
Those late night infomercials that people get caught up in, right?
Yeah, but not even just that. I mean, you kind of, you know, you hear stories about some guy, you know, just bought an investment property and it's kicking off cash like crazy and he doesn't have to do anything. And it just, you know, the tenants do everything. And you hear these stories and you think, like, oh, it's easy. All I need to just, you know, get some money together and then life will be easy. And it's absolutely not the case. That being said, I mean, I like this work. So I feel engaged, like what you guys are talking about. Like, just, you know, it's night and day. When you're working hard at something that you hate, it's very stressful, right? I mean, it's really a recipe for misery and an early heart attack, right? But when you're working hard on something that you enjoy, it doesn't feel like work. And there are times when I feel, maybe you guys have experienced this, that, boy, I really ought to be working harder. And I ask myself, like, well, why? I'm working a lot. What does that mean? And it means that I'm not miserable. So I feel like if I'm not miserable, I must not be working, right?
Now you're engaged. You're enjoying what you're doing. Totally. I experience that all the time.
Yeah. Well, listen, you're in the legal trap. Or same with me. It's hard when you're in a restaurant. You make a sandwich, you make food, you send it out. Jake and I whipped out the chainsaw yesterday. We actually saw physical work. We actually saw us doing work, right? when you're doing what we're doing, sometimes it's not really theory, but it's something you're not getting it done. You're not generating the revenue yourself. So it's hard to put the two and two together, and it doesn't feel like work, although you're creating a tremendous amount of value. So that's where the disconnect is. And I'm still struggling with that because I'm used to saying, okay, at the end of the week, I did 20 grand in sales. I took home this much. But in real estate, it's a little bit more, it's called hyperbolic disconnect, where you have that short term, you're used to making that money short term, but we have a more of a long term mentality now where it's not instant gratification. So it's really a harder model to work with. It's a much more gratifying model in the long run, but it's so difficult to attain that and to see that, you know, mentally. And it takes a lot of effort and a lot of discipline to do what we do, you know. And as long as you're engaged in all that, that's awesome. Why don't you tell me about your first deal? How'd you get your first deal, and what did you learn from that first deal?
Yeah. So just to sort of finish up the story. So with the first partnership, you know, we were looking at deals in Louisiana and Texas. And, you know, to make a long story short, we had some deals under contract. We weren't able to close them because we had banks back out on us literally at the last minute. And it was really devastating. We didn't really recover from that and decided to pack it in and go our own way. One of my investors, actually the guy who originally put the seed in my mind about finance, then said to me, why don't we start something ourselves? I'll back you. And that's how I started Two Bridges. So once I started Two Bridges, I had been looking, even when I was at TRB, I had started looking at Charleston as a potential market, because we had decided, like, hey, we want to diversify. Don't want to be just focus on one market. We want to have sort of multiple markets that we're working on. And I just really liked Charleston. I had some friends down there. I could see what was going on. And then when the census data came out, I was actually able to verify with facts what seemed to be going on with the growth down there. And so I had made some contacts in real estate down there. And as soon as I started Two Bridges, one of the first phone calls I made was to this real estate guy that I knew down there and said, hey, you know, I'm in business for myself now. I'm coming down there. Let's start looking for deals together. So we spent quite a bit of time running around the state of South Carolina, looking at all of the big markets there, with the exception of Columbia. We didn't look at Columbia, but we looked all over the east coast of South Carolina, looked all over the upstate, which is the western part of the state, looking for deals, and just having trouble breaking in because we were new. You know, even though he was a well-known quantity down there, I wasn't, and I was the principal. So we had a very difficult time breaking in. What our break came when Tyler called in a favor from one of his partners on a development deal that he was working on and said, look, you know, we need an intro to somebody, you know, a broker that's going to pay attention to us. Do you know anybody? And as it turned out, this guy had not really his niece, but, you know, called, you know, this kind of old family friend, like daughter of his best friend, you know, and she was a very successful commercial broker out in Greenville, South Carolina. We got an introduction to her. We went out to meet her and literally, you know, walked into her office, exchanged some pleasantries. And she said, guys, I just got a deal in yesterday. Nobody's seen it. You guys want to go take a look? So we drove out and we're like, yeah, this is a good deal. We could just tell from looking at it that it was something that we wanted to dig into further. We dug into the numbers, made an offer, and she got it accepted for us without even showing it to anybody. So that was we finally, you know, after
what year this was this? Now,
this was this was like late 2013, and we closed that deal in very early 2014. But it took, you know, from the time I got into this business, which was 2011, it took me almost 3 years to close the deal.
We started in 2011 and didn't get our first deals early 2013. But that's the thing. Everyone gives up because it's going to take you a year and a half, 2 years. Most of the time, that's what it took us. Took you even a little longer to get that deal. So that's a long time. People will just give up after a while. I actually quit. I burned most of my seed money on a house and had to borrow, you know, money out of my 401k to get into our first deal. So that is, I think that is definitely one of the things where people stumble, is that it's going to take a while and they cannot, you know, stick with it long enough to get into their first deal. And I think that's where most people fail.
But Jonathan, you're an accomplished attorney, right? It took you that long. Jake was a drug rep, and I was a pizza guy. So you can imagine how difficult it is for somebody with no credibility like us to go in there. And, you know, we had a credibility book. We had a whole business plan, but still it took us long. So for all the listeners out there, you've got an accomplished attorney on the other end, and it took him that long to stick into the game. So I don't want to hear any whining from anybody saying, oh, I can't get my deal. There's no deals out there. You know, there are deals out there, but you just got to make that network. That those brokers are golden, because down in East Coast, they're not like here with the MLS up in the Northeast. Those are all brokers that have call to offers. They have these huge buyers lists. And if you don't meet those brokers, you're not going to find a deal. So, you know, coming from, like I said, an accomplished attorney who stuck in there for 3 years, I don't want to hear anybody on the call saying I can't find a deal. If it takes you 2 years, it takes you 2 years. If it takes you 3 years, if you want to do it, you will find a way to do it.
I bet you want it. Yep.
Yeah. He's living, you know. So what made that deal so attractive? What you know, your investing criteria, your numbers, what made that deal look great to you?
Yeah, so first, you know, first physically we rolled up on the property. It had a great location. It was right literally at the intersection of two interstate highways. It had, there was like a mile of factories on one of those highways right out the door. It was the only multifamily property around it. I mean, literally for miles, it had no immediate competition. And the property itself was in decent condition. I mean, the stuff I'd been looking at in Louisiana was like real true C minus stuff. And it was rough. I mean, it cash flowed really well, but it looked pretty rough. And we rolled onto this property and, you know, they said, this is a C. But I tell you, I mean, compared to the C's we were looking at in Louisiana, this place was a palace, right? And
love those properties. No, that's great. You know, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and we're there in the middle of the day. There's hardly any cars in the parking lot. You know,
yes.
The cars that were there were like nice late.
They were cars. They were at the factory because they were working, right?
Exactly. They were over at BMW. That's where they were, right? Where the huge BMW factory, you know, a few miles away from this place. That's where those folks were, and. So we just said, you know, this just looks like a good deal. We got the numbers out. You know, we're looking for cash flowing deals like you guys are. We're underwriting on current numbers. We're not doing a lot of, you know, assumptions on what we think this property is going to do. We apply really, really, really modest, you know, rent growth projections to these properties, you know, even less than we're getting. I mean, for instance, we've been getting 5% or more rent growth a year on our properties. We still underwrite at 3%. I'm not going to underwrite at 5 because I don't know how long this is going to continue, you know? So, and that's what we did. And it penciled out. We were buying it like at an 8 cap and, you know, for a property that was 100% full. And it just seemed like a good deal. So
what were the numbers? What did you buy it at? Do you remember what you bought it at?
So we bought that property for $4.1 million. It was 102 units. So it was just shy of, you know, it was right around 40 a door. And
what is the market escalated to now? What do you think the per door unit is down there right now?
I mean, I estimate for that deal we could probably get 50 a door for it.
That's great.
I mean, we've been buying and bidding at that level for similar, I mean, maybe slightly nicer properties, but still generally competitive properties, you know. 50, even, you know, 54 a door we bid for one recently that was very similar in profile, slightly nicer neighborhood in the same town. But
can you talk a little bit about the seller? I mean, was the seller motivated to sell? I mean, how did that work that you got
so
such a deal?
He's a flipper. He's like a well-known flipper in that market. So he is never holds. He just, all he does is buy distressed properties. And he was very fortunate. He came along at the right time. He had, background in something completely different. And there was a big group that came in to that part of South Carolina right before the bubble. I don't know what their background was. They must've had some kind of, you know, Wall Street money or something that behind them, they bought up a whole bunch of multifamily throughout the upstate in South Carolina right before the crash. And then they just went belly up and they probably overpaid for everything and they just walked away from everything. So all the stuff was foreclosed on, and he just started at the right time and picked up some of these things super cheap and just rolled it, you know, and he just bought one, flipped it, rolled the proceeds into the next one, you know, hold for a year. So he gets capital gains treatment, did a 1031, just, you know, rolled himself up from nothing into like a multimillionaire in a couple of years. So we bought one of his deals.
That's awesome. Yeah. How has your investment strategy changed at all in the last 5 years, or you're basically still got the same model? And can you describe your model for us?
Yeah, we haven't changed a bit. We've just changed markets, like I said, from Louisiana to South Carolina. But my strategy was formulated in the aftermath of the crash. So I was always thinking about how do I minimize my downside risk, right? So first of all, that is like multifamily, right? That people, you know, you have a recession, people, businesses go away, people don't go away. They always need a place to live. And so that was the first thing. You know, the second thing was your cash flow. You want to build in a margin of safety. You can't assume appreciation, because that involves trying to guess where the market's going. And, you know, nobody has, you know, if you have a crystal ball, please call me. I promise I won't tell anybody else. but you have to be thinking about, building in as much safety as you possibly can. And the only way to do that is with currently cash flowing properties. So that was really my thinking. That hasn't changed. And even going into the kind of market uncertainty that we're looking at now, at least in my view, I still think that's the strategy to pursue. I advocate, and what we do is, we look for very long-term holds.
I want to talk about that. When you say market uncertainty, are you saying that you're seeing cap rates being compressed and it's getting a little silly with the price of the multifamily assets that you're seeing? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, exactly. Like I don't think it's going to crash tomorrow. Maybe we've got another couple of years to go, but I certainly feel we've got a correction coming in the next
a little bit of a bubble starting to. Yeah.
And just because the pricing can't sustain itself forever. At this level, but if you do, so the strategy that we follow is intended to be able to ride that out.
Because you're buying on actuals, you're buying on what it's doing today.
We're buying on what it's doing today, and we intend to hold it for a long time. So we're getting long-term debt at fixed rate, long-term debt, and we're not worried about refinancing on the short term. We're not worried about selling in the short term. So. Our strategy is not dependent on the market continuing to be strong for the next 3 to 5 years. We're looking to exit on the next cycle, right? So we're not worried about where this cycle is going, and we don't feel as pressured to buy. Obviously you always want to buy at the right time. You always want to buy low and sell high, right? I mean, that's kind of basics. But so all things considered, you'd rather buy in a soft market, but you got to transact when I can't wait for the market to change. I don't know when it's going to happen. It could be 3 years from now. So we've got to continue buying just to continue growing and moving and building our portfolio. But if that's the case, then you really have to be thinking about where's the market going and does this strategy fit? I've heard people advocate that, at the top of the market, you should be flipping. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. Because it still involves timing the market, and especially if you feel like you need to hold for a year to avoid the income tax treatment, if you want it to be capital
gains. You're stuck and you're getting taxed. Yeah, you're stuck.
Yeah, so you're kind of like, you're really taking a big risk as far as I'm concerned. Like, find a good deal that's cash flowing now where you can do a little bit of value add to it and just hold that, for a long time.
I love what you're saying, man.
That's the safest way to do it.
Beat that drum. You're spot on. I love everything you just said there. That is great.
Well, Jonathan, I think the most important thing that people should realize is not what you buy, it's what you pay. And people don't understand that. And it took me a long time to realize that. It doesn't matter what you're buying out there. If you're buying it wrong, you're stuck forever. But if you're buying it right and you do have that correction, which we're going to have the correction, but if you have those built-in numbers, you're going to be able to weather the storm. Because like Jake likes to say, you can't live in the internet. That's just the bottom line with the millennials and with the – I just said it yesterday. People, every 7 seconds, somebody's turning 60 years old in this country. People are going to have to find an apartment. Now, we're not going to get the 5% rent growth going forward as we've had the last few years. But still, numbers are there. So if you can buy the property, with you said, with value adds, I think it insulates you. How do you assess the market, though? What attracts you to South Carolina as opposed to Louisiana or any other of the markets?
So with Louisiana – perfectly honestly, I was always a little bit uncomfortable with that market because it's very dependent on energy, And I'm old enough to remember the 1980s when the last time the energy market fell apart, and you know, Louisiana and Texas had some serious trouble back then. So that always made me a little bit nervous. But I went along with it because my, you know, my then partner already owned a bunch of property down there. And that's why we were down there. She knew that market. And I sort of felt like, well, I'm the newbie here, so I'll just follow along with what she's doing. But as soon as we broke that partnership up, you know, I felt much more comfortable going to South Carolina. And the reason I was attracted to it was there was a couple things. You know, one I knew a little bit about it because I'd been there a lot because I had friends in Charleston. But the other thing is that, you know, fundamentally, I'm a geek, right? And the census data had just come out. You know, I was literally like, I was on the internet every day, like, when is the census data coming out? When is it coming out? You know, and finally, you know, at the end of 2012, it finally came out, and I just started, you know, beating that data to death. And, you know, like I sorted the whole, all the MSAs by growth rates, right, in the last 10 years, lopped off anything that was under the national average, which eliminates the entire Northeast and the Midwest, basically. And then eliminated anything west of the Mississippi because I just didn't want to travel that much. And what you were left with was like the Carolinas just staring out and just like, you know, leaping out off the page in terms of the growth. And so the whole region that we focus on is basically from like Richmond down to Atlanta is where we'll look. But we're really focused on the Carolinas. And the growth rates were just astonishing. And on top of that, you know, and started digging into things, looking at South Carolina, you know, very aggressive courting of business down there, bringing in manufacturing like crazy. You know, BMW was there, Michelin was there, all the suppliers are following them, Boeing moved in, all the Boeing suppliers are following them, Volvo's moving in, you know, they're doing good things with the infrastructure. They built this inland port out in Spartanburg, which is where we own properties, you know, those kind of logistics clusters are long-term job generators, and they can't go anywhere because you can't build them overnight. I mean, they take years and years and years to develop. So once you've got one there, it's a good bet, you know. So all those things just made it seem very obvious to me that South Carolina was a place to go. Plus, it's easy for me to get there. I mean, I can fly to Charlotte on the first flight from JFK in the morning, fly out last flight at night, you know, and the stuff that we own is close enough to Charlotte. It's an hour away. So basically I can do that in a day if I have to get down there for some reason. So,
and you can visit your friends in Charleston if you have to, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Very cool.
And now I've got like my whole team's in Charleston now. So I've got my guy, Tyler, I've got my lawyer, my accountant, you know, all the folks are down there in South Carolina now.
Cool.
So how have you built those teams? That's one of the big questions that we have. Cause when we started out, we had no, it was Jake and I, it was the I'm a mentality. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. That's what Jake's known for. He's known for doing everything. And as you start scaling up, which you know in multifamily, on your first deal, you scaled up on your very first deal. So how did you build those teams?
Personal networks. You gotta, my lesson has been through all this, you know, whether it's the broker that we were talking about before who helped us get our first deal or what have you, the best folks I've met have always been through personal connections. So when I decided I wanted to go down to Charleston and start looking around there, I reached out to my friends and said, hey, do you know commercial brokers? And I figured Charleston's a small place. If, you know, my friends were, you know, lawyers and doctors and whatnot, I figured if anybody knew, they would know. And I asked them, like, who do you know? And the way I met Tyler was a good friend of mine that I worked with here in the city, who had moved back to Charleston, was really close friends with Tyler's partner's wife, and that was how we met. So when I put out my call for, you know, good commercial brokers, she said, "Oh, well, you know, my friend's husband does that, so I'll put you in contact." And he put me in contact with Tyler, and Tyler was like a golden nugget. The guy had spent 20 years.
And Tyler's the broker, right?
Well, he was functioning as a broker for me. He's really a seasoned multifamily acquisition specialist. So he spent 20 years working for a fairly large fund buying multifamily throughout the Southeast, actually throughout the country, and, you know, bought like 12,000 units of multifamily over the course of his career. So the guy knows everything there is to know about multifamily, knows all the brokers in that region. And he'd been doing development for the last few years, but when this opportunity came up, he was very excited to get back into it because multifamily was his real first love.
So he was the guy, and you hooked up with him early. That's great.
Yeah, I hooked up with him, and that really made my career, frankly. I mean, if I hadn't hooked up with him, I don't know what I'd be doing now. But that was, you know, personal connection, and it was through Tyler's personal connection that we met Kay and the broker out in Greenville, who's gotten us a lot of deals. And then, you know, through Tyler, I hired my lawyer and I hired my accountant, and, you know, those are guys that he introduced me to. So that was how I built my team. You know, the one person from my team, I think, who's my corporate lawyer, is someone here in New York. Again, that was sort of like personal networking. I met her through some other kind of networking activities I was doing up here. But yeah, the team was built.
And she handles the syndications and things like that, right?
Yeah. So she was, you know, she's an alum of a big firm here. She was doing, you know, big, essentially syndication deals for big, big real estate companies, and then went out on her own. So she's working, you know, she does my syndication stuff. And that's, you know, that's how I did it. People ask me this question about how to form your team. I'm very emphatic about the unknown strength of your network, right? Everybody has a network already in place, but they tend to think like, oh, well, I don't know anybody in real estate, so I can't ask my friends. And they go pick somebody random, you know, they found on the internet or what have you. It's a big mistake. Ask people that you know to make recommendations to you. It's always a better start for a relationship, and I think you'll find better people that way. And they'll treat you better. Like, they will take you seriously when you walk in their door the first time, in a way that somebody that you just randomly call off the internet might not. So whether it's a broker or a lawyer or accountant, anybody, I always just strongly encourage people to ask their friends and ask their family who they know as the first step before they do anything else.
Well, you're going to have that in, though, right from the get-go, because you know somebody they know, so they're going to treat you better. So that in is going to be a great icebreaker from the get-go, and they're going to feel obligated to help out in some respect. So
Exactly, because you've got social proof, because you're coming through someone that they already know. And the other thing is, you just never know who's in your network, like your extended network, until you start asking, and you'd be amazed. Like, I had no idea that my friends knew great commercial real estate brokers in Charleston. It was just a guess. That was my first step to go see if anybody did, so I wouldn't have to go and just start like getting on the internet and trying to find somebody.
Right. What is your best habit for success?
Just keep plugging away. You know, every day I come into the office every single day and I work and I try to keep the ball moving and just keep going. I can't really think of any other success, you know, any other habit than that's guaranteed to move the ball. You know, whether you get discouraged or whether you're having a great day, you just keep on showing up and doing the work every day.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because I think a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to start investing in real estate and then I'm just going to hang out on the beach all day. And maybe that works for some people. You got to keep working, though. You got to keep showing up. You got to keep, you know, plugging away, putting in the hours. So I think that's great. What was the biggest mistake that you've made in the real estate business?
So the biggest mistake is not following my gut. You know, when I first got involved in the business, I tended to defer to people I thought were experts, even when what they were saying to me didn't make sense to me. So an example of that is the first property that we own, the management company was having trouble. They were an out-of-town management company. They were having trouble finding a manager for the property. And the regional manager who was in charge of the property found a candidate, and the candidate's background was from affordable housing. And she told me, oh, it'll be fine. She'll be able to learn this business. I have confidence in her. And I was like, I don't know. This has made me really uncomfortable, but I went with their decision, didn't fight it, and it was a big mistake. That manager nearly tanked the property because she didn't know how to market, because she had never had to market before.
We almost did the same thing, because I interviewed someone that was in affordable housing, and I said, well, what's your day like? And the guy was telling me, basically, I'm doing paperwork all day. you know, I'm making sure I'm all the regulations, everything that I'm supposed to be doing is done correctly. People are coming to me. There's no outbound type marketing for those folks. So everything, they just have people lined up trying to get in, and they're filling out the paperwork. So they have no marketing or sales expertise most of the time. And that's why it's funny. I've never ran into anyone that went through the same thing. We didn't hire that person, but it sounds like it was a good thing we didn't based on your experience.
It would be a terrible mistake. I mean, the idea of marketing is you pick up the phone and call the next person on the waiting list, right, when you have a vacancy. And this person was just, she kept on talking, like, this property is so hard to market. Nobody wants to live here. She wasn't doing anything.
Right.
I mean, she didn't go to that mile of factories that was, you know, right outside the front door and try to market the property in any way. Now we have a terrific manager.
We probably have a waiting list there.
We do have a waiting list. Yeah, now we have a waiting list because they've marketed the heck out of the property. Yeah. It's basically always around 100% full, and like you said, there's a waiting list now. But it's because we got the right people in. So that was a mistake that literally 2 years later we're still digging out from, because once the occupancy gets down in one of these properties, it becomes you can start having cash flow problems. You kind of get into a hole, and we're finally now on the upswing at that property, but it's taken a lot of hard work to get it back. And that was a lesson learned. I'll tell you, it'll never happen again.
I like how involved you are in the hiring, even though that you're using a management company, but that's great. What is your, it can be real estate, it can be general business. What's your favorite book that you'd recommend to the listeners that you say, well, you guys got to read this, it's going to help your career?
So have you ever heard of a book called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield?
I have not heard of that one.
Okay. You guys got to read The War of Art. It's actually a book written for authors, right? For people who do that kind of creative work. But he talks a lot about entrepreneurs in there too. And the idea really is you got to just sit down and do the work every day. I mean, that you're engaged in a daily battle against resistance that's trying to tell you can't do it, you're not good enough, you shouldn't do it today, you've got better things to do, or this thing over here is more fun. Whatever it is, you're fighting this every day, and you're in a constant battle, and you can never give up. And the only way is to fight your way through it. And it's just a terrific book. I really, really recommend it.
That was the first 2 years of my real estate investing career, right there. That's so appropriate. That's really cool. I've never heard of it. I'll definitely check it out. What was your best deal and why?
So our best deal so far has been a property called Village Park. And, it's great because it's like beaten our underwriting so badly. I mean, it's crazy. Like, you know, for the first year we had this property, I kept on waiting for the other shoe to drop. I was like, what is the matter? When is the bad news going to happen? Because this property is just...
Where's the dip?
Yeah, it's just blowing up our underwriting. And now 2 years in, it's still blowing up our underwriting. And it is, I think that we really, you know, we didn't think so at the time. This is a funny thing. We didn't think we were stealing it. I was so worried I was overpaying for this deal. You know, it felt like we'd kind of stretched our underwriting as far as we were comfortable going. But as it turned out, there were a couple of things that were working in our favor. One was that, so when you talk about buying on actuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had just instituted RUBS, but they hadn't really taken effect yet. And they had also done, at this property, they had these outdoor spigots that they had always let the tenants use to wash their cars. So they had these ridiculous utility bills, right? They had just capped them because they finally realized they were paying all this crazy water bill. And they had just instituted RUBS, which, as you know, tends to, once people start paying for water, they start using less of it. They become more conscious of it. But none of this had taken effect before. So we bought the property on basically kind of an artificially low NOI because of the high utility bills. And also, they weren't pushing rents. It was a classic story. I mean, these guys were developers. They'd held this property for very... They think they built it, actually. And they'd held it for a very long time. Their basis was nothing. They were probably, you know, for them, their cash flow was probably just terrific because they had no debt on the property or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they weren't aggressively pushing rents. They, you know, they just weren't, they weren't managing the property. It wasn't a priority for them. And so we were able to buy it at really less than its value because of what the numbers looked like. And the numbers, I mean, we wouldn't have bought it if the numbers looked bad.
Right.
But the numbers just didn't support the valuation that the property has now. And if you know, it's a C property, so it's always, you got to be careful about what kind of cap rate you apply to it. But if I'm just going to apply like the prevailing cap rate in the market to the NOI that we have now, we basically like almost doubled the price of the property.
That's awesome.
You know, I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. So very happy with that one.
Very good. What project are you excited about right now?
So I'm working on a few different things at the moment. One is I'm going to be launching a course sometime later this year.
Oh, cool.
On how to do what we all do. And the other thing is I'm also going to be launching a podcast soon. So I was very fortunate in that I managed to develop a relationship with a guy named Ryan Daniel Moran, who runs the Freedom Fastlane podcast. He's launching a new platform called capitalism.com, and he wanted to have a real estate / investing podcast as part of that. So he reached out to me to do that. So we're actually going to be getting that launched in the next few months. So those are like the big project, the non-real estate projects that I'm working on. And, you know, in terms of real estate stuff, we're always looking for deals. You know, we've just been able to raise a bunch of money recently. So we're looking for our next one and, you know, looking to find out what that deal is going to be. I'm very excited about being back in buying mode, you know?
Yeah, that's a bold website name there. How much did you pay for that one?
Lord knows how much you paid for
that.
That
could have been
that
cheap.
That URL. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, so I like to take notes throughout and just some of the highlights that I saw. And what I really, from the beginning, when you wrote down that you wanted to start your own real estate company and it happened, and that's one of those, people get sometimes turned off about it. They say it's woo or like it's like a mystical thing. But man, there's so many examples that yourself and people have shared with us about they've done this, they've written it down, and then, you know, a few years later it's happened. So I like pointing that stuff out. I think that's very cool. 3 years to get into your first deal, but you stuck with it. I'm sure it was tough for those 3 years, but you're happy you've done it, and you're very pleased that you stuck in there. So congratulations on that. And when you were starting to talk about minimize your downside risk, people always need to live somewhere, and that you're buying for cash flow. I could have been talking to Gino. I love that. That's exactly what we do. And I think that is the best advice you could give someone that's wanting to get into this and what to focus on. Minimize your downside risk. Buy for cash flow. If it's making money up front, you're going to continue that even if you see a correction or a dip. So great, great job there. You're talking about keep plugging. And here's one thing that I found really interesting, because I don't know if there's data to back this up, but I've started to see different articles about following your gut, trust your instincts, and you mentioned that, and they're starting. There's just stuff out there. People are writing articles on this, and I think there's probably something to that. And if you would have said, you know what, I'm not going to hire the lady from affordable housing because she doesn't know how to market, and that's what, look, if you're not selling, you're not filling, you're not putting butts in seats, as people like to say, you're not going to be making money. And that's number one. You got to be able to rent the units, and she obviously didn't have that skill set going into it. Just wanted to repeat that. So anyone out there that's getting in and you're about to hire somebody, you got to hire a manager, make sure that they have a background in some sort of customer service or sales, because you got to be able to fill those units. And one more time, The War of Art. I think this is the first time someone's come on the podcast and mentioned a book that Gino hasn't read yet. So I think you get some kind of gold star award.
Let me jump back in there. Yeah, I have never. Yeah, it's really funny because I read every book possible. So I'm excited. I'm going to Barnes & Noble right now. I'm not even going to order. I'm going to buy the book. I'm going to read it by the end of the week, Jonathan. I'm going to call you on Saturday. Say, hey, I love the book. I'm going to talk to you about it with the book. That's awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, please do. I'm happy to talk. That's a book also that I try to reread that book. Periodically, you know, at least a couple times a year, because it's short. It's like 100 pages or so. It's not heavy reading, but it's very. Every time I read it again, you know, I just see stuff in there that I didn't catch, or I see stuff in there that it's like, you know, I now remember it. You know, like I made a note about it before, and then I forgot about it, didn't follow through on it, and it's just a good reminder. It's just a terrific book.
The War of Art. That's great.
Awesome. Hey, Jonathan, it was great having you. Thank you so much for your time.
John.
Yeah, thanks, man. I loved it. I had a great time. Be happy to be on the show anytime you want me back.
Sounds great.
Great. Thanks.
Take care.
We trust that you enjoy the Wheelbarrow Profits podcast. Visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. See you next time when Jake and Gino share more of their investing secrets with you.